Okay, here we go. Stand by.
3, 2, 1.
The Thinking Atheist. It's not a person. It's a symbol. An idea.
The population of atheists in this country is going through the roof.
Rejecting faith. Pursuing knowledge. Challenging the sacred.
If I tell the truth, it's because I tell the truth. Not because I put my hand on a book and made a wish.
And working together for a more rational world.
Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way.
Assume nothing. Question everything. And start thinking. This is the Thinking Atheist Podcast, hosted by Seth Andrews.
Today's show is about health and kids, but it really relates to their parents and to all of us who are not parents. I mean, just people in general. As we get into health, the science versus the woo, good practice, some good ideas, maybe dispelling some medical myths. My special guest, Dr. Nina Shapiro. She's one of America's leading physicians, the director of pediatric otolaryngology and a professor of head and neck surgery at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. You may have seen her on CBS's The Early Show, CNN, NPR. Her work's been featured in The Wall Street Journal, The LA Times, Hollywood Reporter, more than 80 peer-reviewed publications, more than 200 national and international scientific presentations, and she is author of several books, including Hype, A Doctor's Guide to Medical Myths, Exaggerated Claims, and Bad Advice, How to Tell What's Real and What's Not. And her new book, called The Ultimate Kid's Guide to Being Super Healthy, What You Need to Know About Nutrition, Exercise, Sleep, Hygiene, Stress, Screen Time, and More. Dr. Shapiro, thanks for coming back.
Great to be here.
You are an otolaryngologist. What the hell is an otolaryngologist? What is that?
Otolaryngologist is exactly what it sounds like. It's odo, which refers to the ear, and laryngologist or larynx refers to the voice box. So that would just be an ear and throat doctor. So I'm actually an otorhinolaryngologist. The rhino part is just like a rhinoceros. It refers to the nose. So it's an ear, nose, and throat doctor. And you can throw in pediatric because I'm a pediatric otorhinolaryngologist.
I feel terrible for the person that has to print your business card. Is it true that you deal still mostly with children?
It is. It is. I mean, certainly in my practice, it's 100% children. So I see up to about 18 or 21. So plenty of adolescents in there. From a writing and social media standpoint, obviously I deal with a lot of childish adults, but children in my practice, yes.
So remember back when we were kids, I mean, you and I are probably of the same relative generation, but do you remember the four food groups that they used to have in all of our children's textbooks? You know, milk, meat, fruit and veggies, bread and cereal, the four food groups. And I remember thinking, well, this makes sense. Of course, I was seven. You know, it seemed legit at the time. Have you dissected this idea of food groups?
Well, I thought it was like Twinkies, Tab.
Well, I mean, school cafeteria food was always a little sketchy. I mean, we liked it when they served pizza and the chicken and whatnot.
Right,
but,
right.
I mean, it wasn't exactly a vegan health food kind of approach, right?
Hardly. But, yeah. I mean, actually, a lot of cafeterias and schools, some of them have a lot of healthy options, as we call them, healthy options. But there are a lot of schools, especially in the middle of the country, where literally one day is Pizza Hut, one day is McDonald's, one day is Burger King and down the line. And, you know, the schools will contract with fast food places to, you know, it's affordable and, you know, the kids eat it and they love it. And, you know, the schools can make it work. So it's actually still pretty bad, if not worse. But those food groups were interesting. And you know, there is some basis to it if you think about it. So meat, which we would now call protein, was, I think, the food, one of the main food groups, and bread and cereal, which is really just carbohydrates, was another. Fruit and vegetables were lumped together, and was dairy separate? Is that how we did it?
It was. I think they just called it milk. I don't think they used the word dairy. I mean, this is back in the 1970s. I'm sure things have changed.
Right. You know. And it was groups, and then it became a pyramid, and then it became a circle as a pie. And, you know, I think one of the problems is it was this notion of one size fits all, and that we know is certainly not the case.
In the book, The Ultimate Kid's Guide to Being Super Healthy, you start with a message targeted to parents. But the book itself is really kid-friendly. I mean, you know, I mean, it's an easy read for a guy like me, and I think adults can play along, right? But, I mean, who are you going after? Is there an age range that you're hitting?
There is an age range, and the target is elementary school students. And that could be, you know, as young as kindergartners if it's an advanced reader, and then even into early middle school. I think there's enough information and sort of enough basic information that somebody who knows the basics can dig a little deeper for kids in that age range and for adults too. Frankly, I think there's a lot of information in it that I obviously am writing and speaking to children, but I think there'll be a fair amount that adults will, you know, kind of be looking over their shoulders or reading it to their child and learning something new as well. So it's really, again, the voice is to children, but I think a lot of the information will be new to adults as well.
Yeah, I was struck by how this seems like a great read from parents to kids. Hey, you know, today we're going to do the chapter on diet or exercise or whatever, and I'm not going to ask you to read the whole book, but I do want to pinball through some specific things that I found interesting. Natalie tells me I'm a fast eater. Like, my wife looks at me, and we're having dinner, and all of a sudden my food is just gone. And she's like, oh my God, like, enjoy your food, chew your food. What's the matter? I don't even realize I'm doing it. And we say this to kids, you need to slow down. You're eating too fast. That cannot be good for you. Is that a wife's tale or is it true?
Well, I'm the slow eater in my house. I'm always, you know, we're sitting around the table and I am, you know, in the middle of dinner and everybody's already getting up out of their room, you know, going to do their homework or finished, and I'm still eating dinner. So it does annoy me. So I feel Natalie's pain there. You know, there is a notion that if you eat more slowly, you feel fuller more appropriately, as opposed to just eating really quickly, and you're eating so quickly, you don't really have time to sense that your stomach is full, so you keep eating. Is it necessarily harmful? Only if you eat so much that you feel, you know, so bloated and then you're going to get, you know, reflux and, you know, heartburn and things like that. It's certainly not dangerous. It's not really going to alter your metabolism significantly. You know, eating is a necessity, but it's also a social event. So, you know, it's nice to eat more slowly so you can talk while you're eating, have a conversation. We are social beings. It's not just sort of, you know, a functional experience. So maybe slow down a little bit.
I mean, if you and I, let's say you and I were having lunch at a Mexican restaurant, maybe you can relate to the idea they bring out the tortilla chips and the queso a half an hour before they bring out the meal. And I've been grazing for 30 minutes and I'm already almost full by the time the enchiladas show up. But I'm like, I need to eat the enchiladas. I don't know if that's ever happened to you or not.
Right. I mean, if you're at a Mexican restaurant or any restaurant and they bring chips or salsa or bread or anything like that, there's one goal, and that is that you order more drinks. And, you know, that's how they make money in a restaurant. They're going to make it off of the drinks. So, you know, if we're sitting and munching on chips and salsa, we're probably having a few drinks too.
I read somewhere, this may or may not be right, that like soft drinks that cost them a nickel or something, you know, for the carbonation and the syrup or whatever, a dime, and then they can, you know, sell it to me for $2, $3, $4. I don't know. Someone's going to have to check me on that. But you mentioned drinks. I thought that was interesting. How about milk as a drink? Mom used to say, milk, drink your milk, son. It's good for strong bones. I don't know.
Right.
What do you think about that?
Well, milk is a big, you know, it's become this big controversy, mainly, you know, because not just not have it so much as a drink, but that it is an animal product. And should we be, as a society concerned about climate change, reducing our consumption of animal products? That aside, I think milk, cow's milk, is good. It doesn't need to be a drink with a meal. I think, you know, certainly for babies and for young toddlers, it's an excellent source of protein, fat, and vitamins and minerals. It's that simple. If you don't want to get it from cow's milk, you can get it another way. Do you need to drink milk at every meal when you're in second grade? Certainly not. Water. Water is the drink that people should be drinking with meals.
They used to tell us, you know, a gallon of water a day, maybe not for kids, but as an adult. And I think that's based on outdated information. I mean, a gallon's an awful lot of water.
It's ridiculous. So every single food item, including a dry piece of bread, has water in it. So you can get more than a gallon of water, maybe not a gallon, but certainly like the 8 glasses of water per day that people have, you know, sort of thrown around. You can get that just by eating regular food, drinking other drinks. You know, coffee is basically 99% water. Milk is actually, you know, close to 90% water too. So anything that is liquid, vegetables, fruits, you name it down the line, is mostly water. So it doesn't have to be in those, you know, jugs that people are carrying. You know, it looks like water coolers that people are carrying around now drinking. That's complete nonsense.
Oh, if coffee counts, I am way over my quota. I
mean,
so delighted we had this conversation here in your book.
20 ounces every morning, baby.
The Ultimate Kid's Guide to Being Super Healthy. You've got a chapter on exercise. And what struck me was, I mean, you and I, we hear it all the time. You need to stay active. You need to exercise. And everybody knows this, right? But I only know about it really in the most cursory way. I know that it's good for my heart and lungs, and it helps me burn calories. But I've never gone a whole lot deeper beyond that to what's the body doing when I exercise? Why, beyond the fact that I guess my heart is healthier and I'm breathing more, I guess. I mean, but you tackle that for kids in kid-friendly language. Let's talk about exercise from your perspective.
Right. So I break it down. So exercise is, you know, we as adults, I'm going to say older adults, but as adults may think of it as something that we have to do. So you have to go to the gym. You have to go for a run. You have to work out or do a workout class. But for kids, you know, they are natural movers. So I try to break it down for them. So what's going on? Your muscles, and when you think about muscles, yes, the heart is a muscle, but there's also all the other muscles in your body. But it's not just your muscles. It's your joints. It's your balance. It's your flexibility. There's so much more that thankfully kids don't really have to think about because they're just having fun for the most part. But if they do want to think about it, and especially if it's a, you know, reluctant exerciser as a younger child, to think about what amazing stuff their body is doing, even just standing up. I saw there's a great TED Talk out there about balance, and it's just really about you're standing up in a room in space. How amazing is that for your body to accommodate as our world is spinning, you know, millions of miles per hour, that you can just even stand up, that, you know, just to sort of point out these very simple, basic things at how incredible their body is. And kids love those kind of cool facts.
Like, I've got this Apple Watch. I'll tell you how easily thrilled I am. Now, you know, I'll be in the kitchen and it says, you've met your stand goal for the day. And yeah, I'm like, yes, yes, you know, accomplishment, achievement. I've stood.
I mean, we still are looking for those gold stars and those stickers as adults. We you know, our little watch buzzes and you know, we feel a little high, a little, you know, gratification.
Well, let's bump in, though, to, you know, somebody who's middle-aged like me. If, you know, you've got the arthritic joints and you may not have the dexterity and the energy of the younger kid, exercise still being important, I mean, how do you approach that with someone like me?
Well, I think carefully. I think as you age at any age, and that could be 20, 40, 60, you know, any age that you begin to do a new exercise or begin to exercise at all, I think it's really important that you are very careful about it because, you know, once you have an injury, whether it's from overuse or from doing something that, you know, you weren't really careful about stretching or not knowing how to stretch, then it sets you back and it's really disappointing. So I think if you have, you know, an arthritic area, there may be certain exercises that you wouldn't want to do. So talk to your doctor. It's always good to have that conversation. Doesn't even need to be a visit. Could be, you know, now we do everything virtually or a lot of things virtually. Give them a call and they may have some good suggestions.
Do you bother with something like WebMD? I mean, I know there's a lot of pitfalls, a lot of traps out there.
Well, I think, you know, general health, it's always good to start with a primary care doctor because, you know, especially as we age as a society and we are getting older, there are other subtle things, not just about what's the best workout plan, but, you know, how's my heart? How's my body overall? How's my cholesterol? How, you know, all these other risk factors that we need to take into account before we just all of a sudden say, I want to be healthier. just to make sure that you're starting at a good place, that, you know, you don't have diabetes, you don't have high cholesterol, you don't have heart problems, then you can go from there a little more comfortably. But I wouldn't use something like WebMD to diagnose anything going on.
A lot of those websites have a disclaimer too. This site is not designed to diagnose a problem. Some of that's probably CYA.
It all is.
Make sure you don't get sued. All right, so I'm a guy in his 50s, and I still get excited about the breakfast cereal aisle. And I'm not talking shredded wheat, all right? I mean, give me the sweet stuff that's got a cartoon character on the box. There's a prize inside. I'm that guy.
You're that guy. You get the prize and everything.
I don't care as much about the prize anymore, but I want the stuff you can eat with or without milk. You know, and then I want the milk to get chocolatey. And I know what you're going to say, Dr. Shapiro, but go ahead. Give me your take on grocery store aisle cereals and the stuff specifically targeted to kids.
Right. So whether it's, obviously it's targeted to people in their 50s as well. So those are amazing marketing tools. And I think to take away the notion of their being good or bad, I think you just have to take them for what they are, which are snacks, they're treats, they're cookies. You might as well, you know, you might as well have, if you had cookies and milk or one of those sweet cereals and milk, it's the same thing. It's really no different. Just as like a granola bar or a quote unquote health bar, you know, some of them are very high protein, very low sugar, but most of them, you if you would have a Snickers bar or one of those quote unquote health bars, it's the same. So I think once you acknowledge that and recognize that, and for children also saying you can have this, but this is the same thing as having a cookie.
Yeah.
Why can't we have cookies for dinner?
Yeah.
So it's the same idea. And that's okay, but as long as you know what you're doing, then you can make your own decision.
I mean, okay, that's a hard sell for mom. Oh, mom, can I have a Snickers bar for breakfast? They won't do the Snickers bar, but they will do, you know, cocoa happy cereal with the big bear on the front or whatever it is, you know? And it's interesting how our brains don't really see them necessarily in the same way. I'm interested in that.
It's fascinating. And it's really the front of the packaging that it'll say something like, good source of vitamins, which could be like 2% of the daily recommended allowance of a certain vitamin, but they can, from a marketing standpoint, say good source of. So, you know, it's really very deceptive, but it pulls people in. Or something that says no added sugar, but there's still like 50 grams of sugar per serving, but they just didn't add sugar to the already sugary ingredients. That somehow makes it seem healthy.
I remember years ago, the big oat bran thing, where it was some study came out that said oat bran is amazing for you. And lo and behold, within about 5 minutes, there was oat bran in everything, breads and cereals, and you name it, there was oat bran. And then it kind of waned. And it seems like for the last almost decade, we've been in the gluten-free thing, you know, gluten-free, gluten-free, and everybody thinks this is a big deal. But that's not really, I mean, unless you have celiac, right? I mean, can you speak to gluten-free food?
Sure. So gluten-free is a really hot buzzword still. And gluten is actually a protein. It's not a carbohydrate, but it is a protein in many carbohydrates, such as bread and pastas. So if you remove the gluten, you have to replace it with something else. And that something else is usually sugar and fat. That's why gluten-free foods actually taste quite good, because there's more sugar and fat in them. Other things that you can use to replace the gluten is rice. So rice is gluten-free, and anything with rice flour is gluten-free. And so you all of a sudden equate gluten-free with healthy, but it's just different. A lot of people do feel very uncomfortable after they eat something with gluten. And so if they don't want to eat something with gluten, that's certainly fine by me. But they need to understand that that doesn't necessarily mean that their diet is going to be healthier.
Talking here with Dr. Nina Shapiro, author of the book, The Ultimate Kid's Guide to Being Super Healthy. You get into sleep cycles. This is more than just a tactic, right? A way for parents to get their kids off to bed. Oh, look, the book says you have to go to sleep. But, you know, I'm interested in some people I know, they're great with 6 hours of sleep. Other people might need 10. Maybe kids are the same way. I mean, talk to me about sleep.
Kids in sleep, they do need a fair amount. I would say closer to 10 hours per night, really for as much of their childhood as they can. Obviously, babies sleep about 18 hours a day. And as they get older, it's less and less. But even school kids should aim for 9 or 10 hours or even 11 hours each night. And one of the reasons it's different in kids than in adults is their brains are growing differently and they are growing. So one of the things that I talk about in the book is that a hormone, which is a natural substance in everybody's body called growth hormone, is released during the deep stages of sleep. So the more of those stages of sleep you get, the more likely your growth hormone is going to be active and help you grow. So, you know, that little phrase like, oh, did you grow overnight? You know, there's not really truth to that, but there's a little bit of truth to that because growth hormone is released during sleep. It's not like you're going to like grow in your sleep, you know, in a matter of 11 hours, but because you're releasing more growth hormone, you're more likely to, you know, have better growth of your body. And those who are sleep deprived have a little less release of growth hormone. So kids like that little fact, but it is really important for so many reasons that kids, and you know, we're all sleep deprived as a society, but kids really need to get better sleep and longer sleep, I think.
So as someone who treats young children, you probably bump into a lot of parents who justifiably don't want to fall into the trap of over-medicating their kids. You know, I mean, I don't want to get them to the point where they're taking a pill for every little thing, because that way calamity lies. But I'm sure you also run into parents who take that a step further and say, no meds. We distrust medicines outright. How do you deal with that?
So, you know, I think a lot of what we see is if a parent brings a child to a doctor, especially if it's for an acute problem like an infection or a fever, they like to leave with something. It's almost like a parting gift. And that used to be in the form of a prescription for an antibiotic. And so for many years, parents were very insistent on, my child needs an antibiotic and I will not leave the office until I have a prescription for that antibiotic. And then we've seen, you know, all the negatives that overuse of medications such as antibiotics have led to, which is resistant to these infections. So it really depends. I see a lot of people who are potentially going to have surgeries. So the question is, I don't want my child to have surgery. Well, then why are you coming to a surgeon? No. But that's another
story. All the things you don't say, when you don't say the quiet part out loud. Yeah, okay. Okay.
That's another story, but it's true. But, you know, it really depends. And I think parents do deserve, just as kids deserve, an explanation of how medicines work and why we're recommending them and what the risks are of using the medications, but also what are the risks of not using medications. I think we've really done a disservice when it comes to both medications and vaccines, where we don't really explain the risks of not doing something. We only are focused on the negatives or potential negatives or risks of doing an intervention, whether it's medicine or surgery or a procedure. But we don't really talk about, well, what's going to happen if your child doesn't take the medicine? What are the risks of that? And I think if you flip it that way, people often think that you doing something, giving medicine, doing a surgery is a high-risk procedure, but they don't talk about the risks of doing nothing.
I heard a notification over there, probably an angry parent who wants to correct you on your opinion. And on the other side of that coin, you probably see some people who are like, just give me the pill. Right. I mean, they just want to pop a pill or give their kids a chemical or something. I mean, I'm not even sure how else to say it. You ever bump into those people? How do you deal with that?
I do. A lot of it is they don't want to bring their child in for an evaluation. And I understand that, especially these days. You know, can you just, my child responded well to this medicine in the past. Can you just give it again? I know what's going on. I know my child. And oftentimes they're right. And I will. But sometimes one infection is not necessarily the same as another infection. And so, you know, I tend to be pretty, how do I say it in a nice way, rigid.
Well, yeah, I mean, I get you don't want to be sitting there in the parking lot throwing, you know, medicine bottles out into open car windows. That seems hugely irresponsible. I get that.
Right. So, I am really focused on staying consistent in what I think is right for the child, because that is really what's most important. And I understand and recognize the significance of inconvenience, but I also think that doing what's right for the child is, you know, that comes first.
We are far from done with my special guest, Dr. Nina Shapiro, talking about health, especially when it comes to young people. I've got more questions. She's got more answers. We continue next. You want this show early and totally commercial free? Become a patron. Patreon.com/SethAndrews. I'm talking here with Dr. Nina Shapiro about her latest book, The Ultimate Kid's Guide to Being Super Healthy. In the book, you attempt to explain vaccines to children. I was reading it, and I thought, this needs to be targeted to adults. Like, all of us can probably benefit. Fine. Explain vaccines in simple terms for all of us, if you would.
Well, thank you. And that was the goal. It was to explain it to children, because all the children think about a vaccine is a shot and it hurts. So why would an adult who cares for them want to make them hurt? So let's talk about what a vaccine is. So vaccines have evolved, but let's talk about what the current vaccines are. And, you know, one of the hot button issues now is the COVID vaccine. So that's a very, very explainable mechanism for this vaccine. And what happens in this vaccine is it has a material called messenger RNA. It is not DNA. It has nothing to do with genes. It is a little substance called RNA that is transported in a little fat globule. And in this fat globule, it could enter your cell. And then once that fat globule is in your cell, the mRNA goes to something called a mitochondria, which is a little tiny substance in your cells. It is not your nucleus. It is not your genes. It is not your DNA. It is another little part of your cell that makes proteins. The mRNA gives a message to that mitochondria to make a protein. And that protein is something called an antibody. You do not get the virus. You do not get a little bit of the virus when you get the vaccine. It is mRNA that makes your mitochondria make a protein. This protein looks like a little lock. And if you think of the virus as the key, when you get exposed to the virus, it hits up against that lock and it prevents the virus from going anywhere else because the antibody acts as a block. It blocks the virus from making you sick.
Does this explanation also jive with, you know, the flu virus, flu vaccines, other vaccines as well?
Other vaccines are different because they aren't necessarily mRNA vaccines, but they are similar in that they are usually parts of a virus or parts of a bacteria, so a protein from that virus or bacteria, but they have the same mechanism that they make your cells make antibodies, but they don't alter your DNA. You're not getting a virus. The older vaccines, like the smallpox vaccine that I had, I don't know if you're old enough to have had a smallpox vaccine, but we did get a little bit of smallpox virus.
I mean, if I go in for a flu shot, that's one of the protests that I hear as well. You know, they gave me the flu shot and I got the flu. So the shot gave me the flu. That's misinformation?
That is misinformation. That is true and unrelated, as we would call it, or it's coincidence. So you get a flu shot usually during flu season. And after your flu shot, you may be a little bit achy and, you know, you may even be a little bit feverish. And that's your body making antibodies to the flu. That's not your body getting the flu virus. And then you could be exposed to the flu, or you could have been exposed to the flu. And unlike COVID, which you can, you know, be exposed to and become symptomatic 2 days later, the flu, you can be exposed to the flu and it can take a week or two even for you to show symptoms. So you could have been exposed to the flu around the time of your flu shot. And, you know, there is probably something to, after a shot, your defenses may be a little bit down if you're feverish or feeling a little bit achy. So you may be more susceptible to getting sick, but it's not the shot itself that gave you the flu.
I was a big weenie when I was a kid. I mean, you know, I knew the shot was coming, or I had a doctor visit. I was already dreading. Please don't let him give me a shot. You know, I hope the cure for whatever I'm sick with doesn't include a shot. And I would just panic and lose my mind. You dealing with kids every day, how do you get kids through a fear of needles?
So it's a real fear, and I was terrified. I kicked my doctor once. I thought he was really sick, but he gave me a shot, so I kicked him. So I was the worst patient growing up, and I was old enough to know better that that was not a nice thing to do to your doctor. I think the thing when it comes to a fear for a child or an adult, because there are plenty of adults who still have some phobia of needles, is to acknowledge it and say, yes, you have absolutely great reason to be afraid of this. I understand this is a real fear, and you know there are a lot of things that you're scared about, and this is one that's a very reasonable thing to be scared about. So let's talk about, you know, how we can sort of deal with that fear, and not necessarily just say to a child, you know, oh, you know, too bad, just get over it. You know, everyone has to get a shot. Don't be such a wuss about it. Just, you know, buckle up. I'm going to hold you down, and we'll just get it done. So depending on the child, there are a few ways of doing it. One way, you know, if you have the time and the patience, is to do sort of a gradual introduction to the child of, you know, say, you know, poke them with something like a paperclip, like, well, did that hurt? Okay, well, this is, you know, and just sort of advance, you know, these little pinches on the child to show them that they can tolerate little pinches. Another thing is to, you know, work on distractions and breathing and, you know, to teach them sort of techniques that they can do while they're getting the shot. You know, you can watch a show. You know, now it's so easy. You know, everyone has a portable device. You know, you can watch a show while you're getting a shot and do other distractions. Sometimes if you pinch somebody's leg really sort of as a surprise while they're getting a shot in their arm, it distracts from the pain and they sort of, you know, are focused on something.
You little trickster. I mean,
it worked. And then, you know, or to be nicer, you know, there are other things that you can use. So there are these, you know, these creams that you can put on that numb the skin a little bit. There are these freezing sprays. There are these devices, something called a buzzy. It looks like a little bee, and you put it on the skin right before a shot, and it gives a little vibration and a little kind of cooling device to it as well. And it's a physical numbing technique that you can use as well.
Well, where was the buzzy when I was growing up? Because, you know,
it's a new thing.
My parents' generation was like, well, I'll give you something to cry about, you know, just
exactly,
suck it up.
Exactly.
Take the shot.
And then we kicked our doctors, you see.
All right. So you're talking to kids in the book. Are you a brush your teeth once a day, twice a day, three times a day person? I mean, you know, how do we go from good practice to overkill or not doing enough when it comes to telling kids to brush their teeth?
You know, I think certainly at least twice a day. I think just to be realistic, most children are not going to brush their teeth after lunch at school. I mean, who are we kidding? Especially nowadays, if they pull their mask down and are spewing, you know, this aerosol generating procedure, which is toothbrushing, they'll probably get sent home. So the reality is, three times a day for a child who goes to school is pretty unrealistic. I think that, you know, it's a good habit just for oral hygiene at school is for a child to drink water during and after meals. That does actually cleanse the mouth a little bit from all the junk food that they're eating at school, not junk food.
Like, what's the story on fluoride? I know a lot of the, you know, municipalities used to add fluoride to the water and then it affected teeth. Have you gotten into that at all?
Yeah, so fluoride is good, and there should be fluoride in the water. And one of the problems that we were seeing is that when cities pulled the fluoride from their water supply, the dentists were very, very busy. And they were getting in, you know, tons of kids with cavities because they weren't getting enough fluoride. And then there was this brilliant marketing campaign where you can buy bottled water for your child, bottled with fluoride. So they were adding fluoride to water that children would drink as sort of this novelty. And the only reason that that was successful is because fluoride was pulled from the water sources. So fluoride in the water is good. It does prevent cavities, and fluoride in toothpaste is good. You don't want children swallowing, you know, a bottle of toothpaste and, you know, having too much fluoride. That's dangerous, as with anything. But a little bit of fluoride, even if they swallow it, prevents cavities, which is why kids now have fewer cavities than in our generation.
See, I learned something. I learned something on the show.
There you go.
Now, I did know kids in school who would eat toothpaste. I don't know what the attraction was. Like, they weren't allowed to have chewing chewing gum, but they could have toothpaste. I don't know.
Oh, my God.
Dr. Shapiro.
Were they glue, too? Was it the same crowd?
No, we took the glue, and then we put it on our hands and peeled it off. We were very disturbed young children, very bored kids. All right. The year 2022 has plenty of kids addicted to their phone screens. How terrified or worried or concerned should parents be about kids and their phones? What do you think?
You know, I think very. And I think, you know, just as many kids that are addicted, parents are addicted as well. Adults are addicted, if not more so. This last 2 years really emphasized the importance of phones and virtual education and screen education. So then to now ask kids to kind of pull away from that is a huge challenge, really important. But I think that there's a big concern for that. If you look at any school bus stop, you see that every child has text neck, where their neck is kind of, they're not talking to each other, they're all wearing masks, and they're all on their phones, 100%. It's a very strange phenomenon. I don't know if it will ever go away, but it's a big concern. I think that, you know, screens have a lot of value, but, you know, they're overused by everybody, parents and kids alike. And I think the new, you know, generation of kids, you know, this is our chance to try to minimize that so they don't end up like we are.
I remember growing up, this is just an aside, where they would say, parents would say, don't sit so close to the television, you'll ruin your eyes. And now we've got VR headsets that we strap directly onto our heads. I mean, the screen is right on top of my eyeballs. Is text neck a thing? Like, I mean, do we worry about slumping over posture, that kind of stuff with kids?
Absolutely. It's terrible. I mean, it's certainly fixable. You know, these kids are very pliable, thankfully. Their necks are very flexible, so they can stand up straight. But, you know, over years of standing that way, hunched over, they're going to have terrible posture. They're going to have back problems, upper back problems, neck problems, headaches, things like that, eye strain, just from being on their screens for hours on end. It's inevitable.
Let me ask you something outside the book. I can delete this from the conversation outright if you're not comfortable with it.
Yeah.
Came across a video online that showed a chiropractor essentially bending a child into all kinds of positions. Children in chiropractic, do you get into any of that? Are you comfortable talking about any of that?
I think it's really dangerous for a chiropractor to work on a young child. And I have seen some of those videos as well, you know, with infants and, you know, this, supposedly the children have ear infections and they're going to a chiropractor to, you know, realign their spine. That is absolute, utter nonsense. Without question, there's been some major damage caused and certainly no good. So there's a role for chiropractor in an adult with back pain if it's done safely. And I would say what I mean by safely is that if a spine doctor clears them to see a chiropractor for therapy, I think that's reasonable. But to go to a chiropractor outright for a medical problem, especially in a child, is very dangerous.
You're going to get hate mail for talking chiropractors with me? I mean, it's a hot button.
Maybe.
Well,
maybe.
You know, I have noticed that chiropractors seem to be woo magnets. Not all. But there's a lot of like new age and, you know, they get into subluxations, which is totally unsubstantiated based in these sort of mythical old anti-science ideas. And then, you know, as you said, they're prescribing chiropractic. My kids got bad grades in school. Perhaps they need to be aligned. That kind of thing.
Oh, my God. Right. Right. So, you know, I think that if it is something that is harmless, and, you know, where we would sort of be entering the placebo effect, which I am clearly in belief that that is real, then it's fine if you have the means and the time and the wherewithal to do that. It's certainly okay knowing, well, even if you don't know, but, you know, if it's not going to hurt anybody and it's a placebo effect and it helps, then go for it.
If in my case, I think sugary breakfast cereal. I mean, if I believe it has healing properties, then I should definitely partake in that. So I'm going to tell everybody.
But it's not harmless.
oh, not harmless.
Okay.
All right. Any final thoughts on the book? I know a lot of parents want to tool up their kids. Sort of, you know, give me a pitch here at the end of our conversation, would you?
So I think the book is really, my goal for the book is to empower children and to acknowledge that they have really great questions, that kids are curious, and they deserve to have the knowledge of good answers, and that this book will hopefully generate more interest and more questions that kids will have about their health, about what goes on with their body, about what goes on with the world and how it affects their bodies. And really, without the woo or the superfluous stuff that we tell kids all the time, this is good for you, this is bad for you, you need to do this. And, you know, I think that kids really, we don't give them enough credit as far as what they can understand and what they can process to make good decisions on their own. And I think it'll teach adult stuff as well, too.
Read it for your kids. Read it with your kids. Just give it to your kids. Let them read it themselves. The book is called The Ultimate Kid's Guide to Being Super Healthy. What you need to know about nutrition, exercise, sleep, hygiene, stress, screen time, and more. Love the subtitle. It's like its own little mini book. Dr. Nina Shapiro, she is an author, she is an educator, and she has the world's longest business card, as we have established earlier in this conversation. You're always a pleasure to speak to. I'm so thankful that you're an advocate for not just kids, but their parents. You're out there spreading science, promoting good science, and I think in a fun and accessible way, encouraging people just to be healthier and to live better lives. So, Dr. Shapiro, it's been an honor. Thanks for talking to me.
Thank you. It's a lot of fun, as always.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter for a complete archive of podcasts and videos, products like mugs and t-shirts featuring The Thinking Atheist logo, links to atheist pages and resources, and details on upcoming free thought events and conventions. Log on to our website, thethinkingatheist.com.